Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest today is Michael Cruz. Michael is the clerk of the Fourth Court of Appeals in San Antonio. Welcome to the podcast, Mike.
Thanks for having me, Todd. Thanks, Jody.
Well, let's take a few minutes and let our audience get to know you a little. Tell us a little bit about your background, your education, sort of where you come from, and quick sketch on how you got where you are.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here and representing the Fourth Court of Appeals. A little bit about me. Let's see, I was born and raised in San Antonio, here in San Antonio, Texas. I went to high school on the south side of town. I went to St. Mary's University for undergraduate. And afterwards, I went to law school and graduated from the University of Texas School of Law. After that move, that was back in 03 to 06. Then I just stayed in Austin for like the next 17 years. Part of it was figuring out what I wanted to do with my career. I never did practice law, but I found myself at the Supreme Court of Texas in 2011, working under the Honorable Blake Hawthorne in the clerk's office. I started as a deputy clerk back in 2011. I worked for the court, the Supreme Court, for almost 8 years. About half that time was as a deputy clerk. And about half that time, I served as an executive assistant to the Honorable Eva Guzman. After that, I spent about a year at the Attorney General's office working as the office manager for human resources. And in 2019, this court appointed me as clerk of courts, serving the Fourth Court since November of 2019.
That's some great experience. Gosh, I can only imagine. We knew that you had worked for the Supreme Court and also for Justice Guzman. And I think maybe one of the times that Blake Hawthorne was on our show, I think maybe he even mentioned you by name. I'd have to go back and check the record on that. But Blake certainly speaks well of you. And I've had the pleasure of coming across you more than a few times in some of the things that we do outside of our day-to-day responsibilities. You came to Austin and stayed 17 years, but it sounds like you had an opportunity to go home to San Antonio. And what a great opportunity it was to take a job with the Fourth Court of Appeals.
It was truly a dream job, a dream come true. My parents were ecstatic when I told them I was coming home. My brother and my sister-in-law and their family live here. Luckily, my girlfriend, she's from Austin, so we're not too far away from her folks either. So,
I was going to say, I guess the good news is when you got to the San Antonio court in 2019, nothing major happened right after you started.
Jody stole my thunder because I was thinking the same thing about, welcome to the job, Mike. Congratulations. Oh, yeah. By the way, we're entering a global pandemic.
And we're going to have ransomware.
And the ransomware. Yeah.
I think we've reached the PTSD part of the interview, probably. Just a quick recap. I came in the beginning of November, November 4th, it was 2019. And I had approximately 4 months of what I would then come to know as normalcy. One of the funniest things is that at the Fourth Court, there was not a telecommuting program when I started. That was just the culture here at the court. And greatly, we are all back. There is a work from home structure the court does allow, but the majority of the time everyone's in now. But back when I started, that was not the case. It was more the exception rather than the rule. And one of the things I came into my interviews, now hindsight is 2020, and I probably put my foot in my mouth during my interview with the judges because I told them that back when I worked for Blake, I helped draft a telecommuting policy for the Supreme Court of Texas. And the response that I heard was, we don't work from home at the Fourth Court of Appeals. And I was like, okay, great. And then it would be in March 2020 that it went from we don't, it's the exception rather than the rule, to the point that everyone had to work from home. That was a big scramble. Obviously, we didn't have a lot of the infrastructure in place for that, but we quickly got that together with the help of the Office of Court Administration. They were helping out all courts across the state. Then we got into a groove, probably about a month in. We never skipped a beat with oral argument. There was 1 month where we didn't have it, and that was in the course of us transitioning to home. And then within a month, I believe, month and a half, we held our first Zoom oral argument. And we continued that throughout the entirety of the pandemic until we came back.
Interesting to me that, I mean, when you said you didn't have a telecommuting policy or formal program, I thought, oh, does that mean just work from home? But you made it clear in what you said that, no, this was, y'all considered this to be an in-office job. The work took place within the four walls of the Court of Appeals, which certainly has its advantages. It's easier to leave your work at work if you literally don't work from home.
Sure.
But yeah, that change obviously was necessary to deal with the pandemic. I think you said that you're mostly back in now. Is there more flexibility now than there was before the pandemic to work remotely?
There is. I just make the point that we're in 90% of the time. But yeah, there is now more flexibility. That obviously there was proof of concept during the almost year and a half that we were at home and still cranking away. And then, Jody, you mentioned the ransomware attack. May 8th, 2020. I'm not at all scarred by these experiences. That was something that I don't think anyone, you could interview all the way up the chain at the Office of Court Administration. I don't think anyone could have anticipated that something like that was going to quickly take down all of the court's websites and all of those things. That was, from the clerk's office point of view, a huge problem to solve, a huge puzzle to solve.
Absolutely.
But I think I'll take this opportunity to brag on my staff for a moment, because especially my chief deputy clerk, Luz Estrada, she manages the deputy clerks in the front office. Few things have to get to my desk because she handles all of them. And as it pertains to this ransomware attack, we had to keep taking in filings because, as y'all probably know, there's eFile Texas, and that's separate, where then the court's websites, the court's infrastructure, the database infrastructure that we use called TAMES, that's a separate organization, it's a separate entity, and that was up and running the entire time. We needed to continue to take in filings, also while knowing that we couldn't effectively put them in our database, and we couldn't send notices the way that we typically do. It was difficult to send out orders from the court. Our website was down. And they did just this magnificent job of meticulously bookkeeping in the old way. We had an Excel spreadsheet that we would fill in every time there was a new filing. Case number, who filed it, name of the case, all of the information. Fast forward about 2.5 months later, we were down for about 2.5 months. And then I got the call from Casey Kennedy at OCA saying, all right, we've stood TAMES back up. Your website's back up. Thank you for your patience during all of this. I mean, that guy could probably write a book about what he went through.
Yeah.
But it was a great day where I was able to chat with my staff and say, all right, now we've got all of our tools back. What's the plan of action? And the plan of action, in short, was that they were all winners. They just went in and attacked that backlog every single day. And 2.5 months worth of backlog was cleared through in 2 weeks flat.
Oh, amazing.
Wow, that's incredible.
I cannot say enough about that Herculean effort.
By way of context, I don't know how many of our listeners will know, but if you haven't looked at a map of your district, you have one of the geographically largest districts. Can you describe the parameters of that? Because it's huge.
Sure. It's 32 counties. It's Bexar County and all the surrounding counties. Obviously, Bexar County is our biggest customer, so to speak, in terms of the percentage of cases that we get out of that county. I'd say that we certainly get close to 1,000, if not more, cases filed per year. We have 7 judges on our court. They're constantly working. As y'all know, they work in panels of 3. We will cut them up into 2-3 judge panels. One judge is off docket every 2 months. That's kind of a misnomer. They're not really off docket. They're just not being assigned new cases. We're like the post office. It never stops. Never.
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly, and Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a billion-dollar appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today.
I hadn't considered that when you got an odd number of judges on a court, especially when it's not divided by three. That's an interesting, you got, I guess, a panel A and a panel B or something like that. I've seen that reference. But no, the listeners shouldn't be confused. I mean, there's still plenty of work to be done, more than sufficient work to be done behind the scenes, even if you're off docket. How long did you say that the judge was off docket?
2 months. Each judge will be, and it's normally, it just goes in order of seniority. So whoever is,
rotates.
Yeah, it just rotates every 2 months.
How is oral argument assignment affected by a judge being off docket? I guess, is it determined at the time the case is filed and then the life of the case, that's your panel? How does that work?
No. When a case comes in, I guess I should preface this whole conversation with saying that on the Fourth Court's website, on the left-hand side, we have like a little ribbon. One of them is practice before the court. If you go ahead and click on that, they'll take you to a page that has a lot of our internal documents, including our internal operating procedures, which is public facings. So what I'm going to be talking about now is all there in case the listeners want to go back and have some Saturday night evening reading. I know that this is an academic bunch.
I would say that might put them to sleep, but with our audience, no, it wouldn't.
Might actually keep them up, right? Riveting. When a normal case comes in, it's filed and it's assigned to a staff attorney, and that's called the monitoring staff attorney. There's a monitoring phase while we're waiting for the record to come in, the briefs to come in, before something is at issue and set for submission. There's that first life of it when it's in monitoring. It does not yet have a panel assigned. Then once those cases come at issue, we will go ahead and create our different docket draws for the month. We'll look at the previous month, which cases came at issue, select that, and divvy out docket draws throughout the year. Once case is assigned to a submission panel, that's when the panel is set. I think it's maybe worth noting for a second, too, about it's more than just dividing the cases up. And I have great staff here, Elizabeth Montoya, who's one of the legal assistants here. The docket draw, like I was saying, one of the members of my staff, one of our legal assistants, Elizabeth Montoya, she greatly handles the docket draw for all normal appeals. The way that it works is you had asked whether or not a panel, whether or not you know the panel from the filing of the case. And the answer for regular appeals is no. There is, when a case is filed, before the briefs have come in, before the record has come in, what's known as the monitoring phase. And like I said earlier, all of this you can check out in our internal operating procedures. But the monitoring phase is basically we're waiting for the briefs to come in. We're waiting for the record to come in. Once everything's ready to go, we set it at issue and set it for submission on a docket draw. And we do those every month. We do that at the beginning of the month, depending on who is off docket for those months. That would be the judge that is not on either panel A or panel B. We go like that throughout the course of the year. The other point that I wanted to make was we do have to juggle instances where judges may be conflicted for whatever reason, recusals, things like that. We will try to make it to where we equalize the number of cases and we have the largest number of cases that we can assign per docket draw to get those moving through the court. It's a little different with parental terminations. Parental terminations are on a 180-day deadline from the date of filing. And so those are on an accelerated, expedited time schedule. And we actually do assign panels immediately upon the filing of a parental termination case. That way it just speeds it along. There's not the instance where perhaps the monitoring attorney then passes it off to another chambers for parental terminations and accelerated appeals. And actually, original proceedings, those are all on their own matrices, we call them. And that is just the way that we assign the cases to ensure randomness and to assure an equitable distribution of both authorships and panel memberships. There's a lot of moving parts. All sure. that to say, just a lot of moving parts.
It's really helpful to refer to the IOP document. I know Blake Hawthorne has spent a lot of time talking about and writing about the Supreme Court internal IOPs. We've got similar documents out there for the Fifth Circuit, and I think it's really helpful. You follow the same rules of appellate procedure and the same law generally, but there are practices that are specific to each of the 14, eventually 15 appellate courts. And so one thing that this lawyers, we need to be reminded of sometimes is don't forget to check the local rule, or in this case, the IOP, even if it's not a local rule per se, because it will tell you a lot of what you need to know in practicing before any specific appellate court. Going on, I wanted to ask a follow-up, though, on the about the motions docket. I know some courts have certain ways that they do it with motions. It's basically extensions of time. I know with the Supreme Court, it's basically the clerk's office that handles at least the first, maybe the second request on those, especially if they're unopposed. Anything specific about the way that the Fourth Court handles its motions docket that would be useful, even if it's included in the IOPs?
Sure. There is an order attached to the IOPs that delegates the granting of certain motions for extension of time to the clerk's office. Those, I believe, I don't have them right in front of me. There's a shortened time period, or I guess less leeway granted to the clerk's office to grant those in termination cases. If we have any misgivings, though, we typically will run it by the monitoring attorney or the staff attorney that is assigned, just to make sure that the chambers is good with whatever extension is being granted. But generally speaking, just in terms of advice for practitioners, sometimes we'll get motions where the certificate of conference says that they tried to get a hold of opposing counsel, but don't currently know whether they're opposed or not. It's a lot easier when you've gotten a hold of your opposing counsel so that we're not having to run interference and say, you know, call them up and ask if they're opposed or if they're going to file a response and things like that.
Would all prefer to know what the opposing side's position is on a motion. And, you know, motions for extension of time are so routine, that's usually not too tough. It's a little dicier when you get into substantive motions. I assume those go to more than one staff attorney, or would they go then to potentially I kept saying, you know, a motions panel or motions docket. At some point, does a substantive motion, like say a motion to dismiss, wind up in front of a panel?
Of course, right? The only motions that my office would be granting would be the, you know, really the unopposed motions for extension of time, and normally like a first, perhaps a second. Anything dispositive or a substantive motion, that's always going to go to whichever attorney that the case is assigned to, and then that attorney will run it through the panel. Suffice it to say, yes, all substantive motions are always going to go before the panel, and obviously those are handled as they come in. We do get calls from practitioners asking about the status of motions. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously, most of the time we tell them, you know, the clerk's office, you know, we exist to be siloed off from that substantive decision making, and we only know about it once it comes across our desk, and we need to make sure that the public knows about it. So, you know, to that end, unfortunately, we can't really give any information when we get calls like that. Rest assured that motions move in due course through the court and as expeditiously as possible.
That sort of siloed nature, you're a bridge between the court itself and practitioner, or the, say, pro se litigant. But I know one thing that you pride yourself on, as do many of our clerks of intermediate courts and the Supreme Court too, is being accessible. How many phone calls would you say on an average day you yourself handle from a litigant or a lawyer asking questions? I assume there's little levels of triage. Escalation. I'm going to escalate you up to the clerk, Mr. Cruz.
Sure. I would think those, to answer your initial question, it depends. It kind of ebbs and flows. It's invariably on a day when I'm very busy that I will get a lot high volume
naturally.
Phone calls. I would say that the phone calls come in two major flavors. The practitioners checking on status of cases, perhaps asking questions about how to construct briefs and things of that nature. 90% of those calls, my staff is going to handle, or Mrs. Estrada, my chief deputy clerk, she's going to run interference on 90% of that stuff. And it normally only is when, well, I told my staff, if somebody asks to speak to me directly and I'm here, just let me know who it is and forward it along. Because if I'm here and they want to talk to me, that's my job. But my job is to be accessible to the public, whether they're practitioners or pro ses. Pro ses is the other major flavor that phone calls may come through, but that's normally the situation. It's not so much practitioners insisting to talk to the clerk of court. Many times it's pro se litigants or family members of pro se litigants that may be incarcerated, trying to find out the status. And I get those via phone call, but frankly, at least half the time, if not more, that's a situation that occurs at the front desk. They've come downtown to the courthouse. I don't know how familiar you are with San Antonio, but there's actually two different courthouses. There's the Bexar County Courthouse, and then there's the Cadena Reeves Justice Center, and that is attached to the Paul Elizondo Tower. And for someone coming in who is not a party to the case, but is trying to check on the status for a loved one who may be incarcerated, it can be a daunting task to just bring yourself downtown, figure out which building you're supposed to be in, what floor you're supposed to go to, who you can talk to, and what questions you're allowed to ask. And my staff knows this, and they do a wonderful job of patiently walking pro se litigants through whatever the status of their case is, whether it be closed, whether it be pending, whether they haven't filed anything yet and they don't know the first thing about a notice of appeal because they were represented by appointed counsel at the trial court, but they don't have appointed counsel for the appeal and they don't know where to start. Some of those members of the public I've found, and partly from my experience at the Supreme Court, is that you need to spend a little bit of extra time and care walking members of the public through the process. And more than just providing them Tyla's very comprehensive pro se litigant guide, I can print it out for you and give it to you and say, good luck, go on your way. But that doesn't feel sufficient to me. And so much of the time, either my staff or the chief deputy clerk or myself, you know, goes out and talks to pro se litigants and gives them as much information as we can. And it's been my experience that a majority of the time, anything I tell them isn't going to be anything different than what my staff has told them. But having someone come and talk to them and patiently walk them through can really mean the difference between feeling like you've actually helped a member of the public or done bare minimum. And that's a point of pride for my office. So it's not just me going out and talking to every pro se. That's actually the exception more than the rule. It's my staff that handles a lot of this stuff that I never see. And really, I'm only called in to talk with over the phone or over the counter people after they've given the information themselves.
That's a sign of a well-trained staff if they know how to handle those questions. As you say, I mean, you have certain patterns, I'm sure, would show up from time to time. But you mentioned a couple of folks on your staff. How many people do you have within the clerk's office?
There are 10 people that work for the clerk's office, 11, including myself. I should probably take a second to name all of them, because they are the heart and soul of this office. I oftentimes joke that, like, I can get hit by a bus. If one of them even stubs a toe, we're in trouble.
By all means, recognize them, please, because I really appreciate what you're saying about the staff and how they can handle things. And we all know that court staff generally is underappreciated by the folks that consume the services that the courts of appeals offer. I think it's beneficial too to know them a little bit and to know what the different responsibilities are, you know, between and among the different positions on the staff, because it's just the better you know, the more you know about these things, the easier the interaction is, really on both sides. By all means, give them a shout out and recognize them by name and tell us among the different responsibilities that they have, the positions. We'd love to hear about that too.
Absolutely. I'd love to. I'll start with the deputy clerks. They're our frontline. They're the voices of the court. They are the face of the court, really, because those are the people that you're going to see if you come over the counter or if you call us up. Our newest deputy clerk, Diane Cuellar, she serves as greatly the receptionist and the point of first contact for people that come over the counter or for people that call our office. She routes all of the calls to the other deputies or to myself or to the chief deputy clerk or anyone else in our office. She's our newest member. She spent many years at the Court of Criminal Appeals in the clerk's office there. She came to us with an awful lot of experience and we're really happy to have her. Then there are the four deputy clerks that handle the caseloads, and they are the people who, the practitioners and the pro se litigants, anybody in the public that's calling for a case status, they're going to talk to the deputy clerks. I'll just name them in random order. There's Veronica Gonzalez, there's Monica Rivera, there is Cecilia Phillips, and then there is Jamie Osio. Those are the four deputy clerks that 99% of what you're going to need to get done, if you call my office, they're going to get it done for you. Like I said, I can't say enough about, with the exception of Diane, let me say this, take a step back and say, I inherited this staff. I came on, these were all hires from my predecessor, either my predecessor or my predecessor's predecessor, the Honorable Keith Hoddle, who is a wonderful resource for me since I took this job, and every day I benefit from the groundwork that he laid here. When I say that this place can run itself, I literally mean it, because they were without a clerk. It was definitely some months, if not an entire year, before I came on. They were very happy to have a body in the seat once I got here. And it's not like I'm sitting around doing nothing all day. But all that to say, they run this place on the daily, and they get the things done for the public that the public needs. Then after the deputy clerks, there are, my staff has two legal assistants that help the court. Elizabeth Montoya, who I mentioned earlier, she handles the docket draw. She handles the internship program. She handles the court memorials. She handles quite a lot, sort of the catch-all of a lot of administrative roles that fall to the clerk's office, and she does a brilliant job of navigating that. Our other legal assistant, Lynn Domain, who has been with the court for, I believe, over 15 years, if not that, then close. She is our legal assistant that gets all of our opinions over the finish line. To the practitioners and to the public, when we release orders and opinions, they just magically appear online. But the reality is that there is a whole process that Lynn is in charge of. Once a case is circulated in white, as we call it, it's basically final form, and then she proofreads everything. She double checks everything. She does all of the entries in our database, ensures that the opinions are sent to Westlaw and Lexis, and all of the various things that happen once an opinion is issued. Again, they back each other up in those various roles. The two legal assistants, they work hand in hand, and they back each other up whenever one or the other is out. Just two key members of the team. And then there are my top three people. Refer to them as the inner circle. I refer to them as the Jedi Council before. It's basically like the three people that I go to say, okay, here's my idea. Now tell me all the problems with it. What am I not getting here? And those people are the chief deputy clerk. She's basically second in command here. She's my right hand with all things that have to do with the machinations of the clerk's office. And that's Luz Estrada. There is the accountant, the court accountant, who is also an HR professional. So she helps me with all things finance, all things human resources related. I serve as the chief financial officer for the court as well. So I handle all the finances for the court. And she is my right hand when it comes to all of those things. And then last, but certainly not least, is the network specialist. His name is Del Merritt, and he's our on-site network technician that handles all of our IT needs here. We're very lucky because not every corp has one, a dedicated tech. And so we're very fortunate to have him on staff. Another person who has been on the staff for 15 plus years, predates even the last work. I have people on the staff that help me with every sort of hat that I wear. Del will also help me with all the facilities stuff. We joke around that people, they'll come to me with the most serious of things, an investigation or something like that, something human resources related, or if the AC isn't working in their office, they call me. If they lost their badge, they call me. All of that to say the clerk's office at our court handles quite a bit. And I need every single person on staff to help me wrangle all of those things. That's the entirety of the staff. I couldn't do any of what I do without their support, and neither could the court.
I feel like when you think of the clerk's office, the kind of traditional picture is, okay, the people that are taking and receiving the paperwork, but it really is sort of the business hub of what is essentially a small business there. In terms of you've got to have all the personnel, the technology, all of that. Mm-hmm. And I don't often think about the fact that that all falls under the clerk's office umbrella.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today.
Yes, and I would say that I'm very fortunate because, you know, I work at a court of appeals that has a lot of resources, including our dedicated tech. Some of my colleagues at the other courts of appeals, they do all the same functions that I do with half the staff or a fraction of the staff. All that to say, I'm always learning every single day. My toolkit, because there's a lot of corporate knowledge here, at some point going to retire. Just like with the staff attorneys and with the judges, we're all renting these jobs. And at some point, the personnel, if you don't take advantage and learn what you can from them, they're going to walk out the door eventually and you'll have lost that opportunity. So trying to take advantage of that opportunity as much as I can.
In terms of your court's docket, are you a transferee court, transferor court, or does it change?
It changes from year to year. Some years we've been a transferor court. Some years we've been a transferee court. Lately, as of probably the summer of last year, we started to become more of a transferor court because we have gotten influx of filings in our jurisdiction in the 32 counties that make up our judicial district. We have been getting an influx of cases stemming out of Operation Lone Star. And those cases are almost exclusively coming to the Fourth Court of Appeals. As a consequence, the Supreme Court does something I'm sure you're familiar with, their docket equalization that they do every quarter. And they do that by compiling the statistics of all 14 courts of appeals and comparing and contrasting the percentage of the state's cases that, like, per judge on the court. In the last year or so, the judges on my court have been receiving, on average, I think it's 20 additional cases per judge than what is the average in the state of Texas. And as a consequence, the Supreme Court every quarter tries to even that out by transferring cases out of case filing heavy courts to case filing courts that have less filings by comparison.
Tell us real quick what Operation Lone Star is, just so we can close the loop on that, because it sounds like that's, yeah, really added to the docket number for the fourth court.
Sure. Obviously, politics aside, my understanding of Operation Lone Star and these cases that are arising out of it is that there are illegal immigrants coming across the border that are then being arrested for a crime. And then subsequent to that arrest, they're being deported. As a consequence, we have had sort of waves of filings come in because many of these defendants, their hearing will be set for the same day and with the same judge in the same county, will get in like a wave of 20 or a wave of 40. And that's not normally the way that we receive filings. I mean, even on a heavy day, we're not necessarily going to receive 40 filings all at once. that's been the latest, I guess, challenge that staff has had to navigate in terms of the rate at which the cases tend to come in. Now, then we go a few weeks without getting any cases like this, but then we'll get another 40 or another 50 cases at a time. And I think that really, it's the timing. Well, it's the timing and the volume, obviously, the overall volume throughout the year, because if things were as they normally were, we wouldn't be transferring cases out to other jurisdictions.
It was really useful to hear about the staff roles. Just so we understand, I mean, I think the three of us know, Jody and I certainly know generally what the clerk of the court, part of the responsibility is to be the public facing face, as it were, of the clerk's office. And aside from the folks who come in and get some counseling on as much as they can about certain things that the pro se litigants or family members need to know, what really goes into, aside from helping to manage the facilities and the finances and the things that you told us about, what goes into being the actual clerk of the court? It's largely, I guess, an administrative job, and you're just overseeing the other folks that work in your office. What are the things about it that make it unique and the things that you enjoy?
Sure. I think my colleagues would tell you that there are buckets of things that we do on a daily basis that touch on those areas that you just touched on. In my financial role, I'm the chief financial officer, so I oversee all expenditure. Any expenditure that the court does comes across my desk and I approve it. Certainly handle all of the legislative reporting that a government agency has to comply with. Many of those things on me, like the legislative appropriation requests, things like that, that I do in conjunction with my staff members. Ultimately, I, and many times the Chief Justice, are the signatories on it. If anybody is going to jail, so to speak, it's going to be me. In terms of human resources, I think that's another large hat that generally involves, sure, overseeing my office, but generally acting as a liaison between any conflict at work, perhaps between other staff members, conducting investigations if need be, things of that nature, anything that would fall under the umbrella of the Director of Human Resources is something that I would be responsible for. And then obviously the role of clerk. My name is the name they slap on everything.
Yeah, you're on the letterhead, Mike. Yeah.
They slap my signature on all the orders and the per curiams. I joke with Dell, the network specialist. He's one of the first guys I met the day that I started. And I was about to be sworn in the courtroom. And he met me and he said, "Hi, my name's Dell. Nice to meet you. Can I get your signature?" Because he was already in go mode. He was like, "Okay, I need a signature so I can update all of these templates in our database so that we can get to work, so right. that we can start issuing things." But I'll tell you some of the more, the thing that I like the best, about this role is really the coming to work and being here and being involved in the day-to-day machinations, whether it be oral argument day where I'm opening court and I'm handling the recordings, the Zoom recordings and all those things, whether I'm representing the court at the NCACC for the National Conference of Appellate Court Clerks. Todd and I both serve on the Judicial Committee for Information Technology. There are things that I do in my role like that, where I represent the court. Like I said, I think that, you know, the greatest joy that I derive from the job is just the everyday getting into work, seeing what fires there may be to put out.
Yeah.
Trying to forecast what fires may pop up during the next quarter, during the next year, just generally being accessible to the judges for whatever they need. I have to manage down and I have to be accessible sideways for the staff attorneys, and I have to be accessible upwards for the judges. And so I've joked with my family before that even when you take a day off, if the court is happening, I'm still on call. I think that there's case law out there that says if somebody tackles me with a filing and says, "Here's my filing," that it's considered filed.
Little used today, but yeah.
It's probably good your picture's not on the website, just in case.
Like I said, it's a dream job to have. It can be very busy at times, but it's very rewarding
probably shouldn't be lost on us that aside from all the HR and the financial stuff and the public facing part of the job, that you really do answer directly to the seven justices on the court. If I recall correctly, clerks of the court generally serve at the pleasure of the court. Even though you're the clerk, you have a lot of bosses.
Yeah, and constituents.
One way of putting it. And yeah, maybe constituents is the better word, but that's a delicate balancing act. And you mentioned JCIT and NCACC. I've seen you participate in JCIT discussions. It adds a lot to those discussions when folks whose boots are on the ground and know, you know, the day in, day out of what's going on in the courts participate in those kinds of things and remind those of us that practice law, the realities of how things work in your organization, because sometimes we can forget if we ever even knew. I mean, I wasn't even thinking about when we started this conversation today about the HR aspects, which, gosh, your time at the AG's office had to be extremely valuable to what you do today. I can only imagine. So I'm going to say thank you, not only for the job you're doing at the Fourth Court of Appeals, but also for being one of those clerks who is visible outside of the four walls of the court. I think that adds a lot to the perception of the appellate courts. You certainly had a good role model to follow in our friend Blake. Blake and his predecessor, Andrew, were both great about that. Andrew Weber. Maybe it all started with Andrew. I'll give Andrew a little credit here. And he's somebody that I've known for a long time.
We should always give credit to Andrew.
Yeah, let's give credit.
Absolutely.
He really is. I could tell you some Andrew stories, and there's probably a few he could tell on me. But the way that he approached the job, I think, frankly, just changed the nature of it and the perception of it just dynamically. And Blake did a great job of continuing that on. Just, I mean, there's really no more I can say except thanks. I really do appreciate the way you approach it. Just the fact that you're willing to maybe get out of your comfort zone a little bit and come talk to us about what you do. I really appreciate it, Mike, very much.
Likewise.
And thank you all. You're very kind. And it's a pleasure for me to be able to do this. It's an honor. Anytime I can represent the court and spread information about what my office does and the great work that they do, thank you for the opportunity to share that with your listeners. And I would say to any of the listeners that if you have some business with our office, just give us a call. We pride ourselves on making contact as soon as possible when the public contacts us and on our accessibility to the public and practitioners. If there's ever any issue, you can ask for me directly, and I'm happy and willing to help out the public and the practitioners with any information that I can provide.
Well, our tradition in wrapping up is to always ask for either a tip or a war story, and you've given a lot of tips. I wondered if you had a war story that you'd want to share. It doesn't have to be from this court.
That's permissible to share.
Yes, that you can actually share publicly.
I would have to say that one thing that I'll end with this, because this was another transition that we had to make, that I'm very proud that our court does. We moved to doing Zoom oral arguments when we went home for the pandemic. Then at a certain point, we knew we were coming back. That was a little bit over a year later. The vaccines had just come out, and there was a desire for us to get back into the office. The judges as well decided to, now they still leave it panel by panel, their decision, but they decided that they would start in-person oral argument again. This is where the war story comes in. This created a unique challenge for myself and Mr. Merritt, the network specialist here, and indeed everyone that helped us get oral argument together. And that's, unlike the Supreme Court of Texas, we did not have like this nice hardwired camera system with a control room and professional lighting with microphones and all of those sorts of things accessible at all. We didn't have any of that. And predictably, the judges, when they came back, they were inquiring about our capabilities of continuing to do Zoom or YouTube live streaming of oral arguments. Prior to that, we would only do audio recordings, and we would provide that to people that requested it upon request. But the pandemic gave us a body of work of about a year long where practitioners and the public were able to just go to our YouTube channel and view oral arguments that had happened months and months ago in their entirety. They wanted to continue this. We put together a proposition and we asked the court for basically one of those top of the line systems. Okay, we've got someone coming in and giving us these quotes, and here's what it's going to cost. And I won't share the final cost because I ended up getting voted down. The cost was in technology is not cheap. I'll say that. But if life has taught me something repeatedly, it's to know when I've been beaten and when I should persevere. And I knew that the price was really the sticking point. We went back to the drawing board. We got another vendor who gave us a substantially lower price on a system that essentially consists of a cart with a television and a computer and a microphone system. And we use webcams, probably very similar to the ones y'all are using right now that are on stands. And so if anybody ever has a chance to visit the Fourth Court of Appeals and look at an oral argument or view our YouTube channel to view what the product has been, I'm extremely proud of what we, in essence, cobbled together with machines that we already had and a less substantially expensive contribution by the court in order to get this up and running. And I'm very proud to say that we still to this day are not only streaming our oral arguments live and have those recordings available for the public, we also stream our court memorials that we do in conjunction with the San Antonio Bar Association. And there have been a couple of times, there was one in particular where there were a number of family members that were unable to attend because of COVID or because of concerns from COVID. And the fact that it was live streamed gave them the opportunity to participate and view that. And I don't know whether you've ever been to one of the court memorials, but it's in essence a very solemn event. Normally it's an attorney or a judge who has passed away within the last year or so. And the family has allowed Fourth Court of Appeals and the San Antonio Bar Association to honor their loved one in a ceremony where a resolution is read about their life into the minutes of the Fourth Court of Appeals, and also a copy is saved in the San Antonio Bar Association's minutes. It's a very solemn event that I'm very proud that we're able to stream for those that are unable to attend. It's just another avenue of accessibility to the public. And in this particular situation, access to people that would love to attend one reason or another cannot. And then the last thing that I'll say that I had never anticipated out of the AV situation that we now have in the courtroom is that there are a number of new attorneys that get sworn in every year, two times a year, like clockwork, sometimes more, when the bar results come out. And I'm very proud to say that we did one swearing in for a young attorney who had a brother that was in Manhattan, had a sister that was in Seattle. They were all able to log on to a Zoom meeting like we are right now, watch them get sworn in live. And if you want to talk about, especially as someone who never practiced law, but has seen, been in the profession and has seen countless number of people get sworn in, it never gets old. It's literally witnessing someone attaining their dream in real time. And then to be able to stream that across the nation, their loved ones. We weren't doing it on our YouTube channel. It was really just for the family. And it was a great opportunity and something I would have never thought of us having the capability of doing that. But that's another, it's just another example of how we've made kind of leaps and bounds in, in our technology and by proxy, you know, our accessibility to the public and in those kinds of specific situations.
That's great. We really appreciate it. And since we're on Zoom, but nobody else can see it, you have a sign behind you on your desk that says work hard and be nice to people. And it sounds like you guys do a great job of that at the San Antonio court.
That's right.
You're very kind. We'll do our best and we'll continue to do our best to serve the public.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at techsapplawpod.com or tweet us at techsapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.